standard. It's what you are that counts. On the last lap, people will no longer admire us for our good looks, our lively conversation, our brilliant minds, our successful careers. Like David, they will look into our bath chairs and they will see there a shriveled husk of our former selves. And if anything is to commend or to condemn us, then it will be written in only one place, in our personality. The personality they encounter, even in the midst of all that pathetic decrepitude. The personality which has been moulded and trained over a lifetime of experience, but which is now fixed and unchangeable. The last testimonial with which the school of life has written upon our spent energies. And the lesson of 1 Kings chapters 1 and 2 is surely this. Strive now, while there is still opportunity to change and to learn and to grow, that that final personality with which we shall leave this world may be no embarrassment to us. For when we are honest and look at David's last lap, we find it ambiguous. Oh, there are signs here of greatness, a greatness of soul. But there are signs here also of a most unattractive mean-mindedness. There's a man here who laid up treasure in heaven, okay, a spiritual man, a saved man. But there is a man here also in whom the work of grace was still woefully incomplete. And the awesomeness of the situation is this, that that imperfect personality which we see in David's old age is the personality he took with him into eternity. Someone has said, we sow a thought and we reap an act. We sow an act and we reap a habit. We sow a habit and we reap a character. We sow a character and we reap a destiny. The last lap is important because in a very real sense, when it comes to winning or losing, it's the last lap that counts. So let's look together, bravely, at David in his old age, not fleeing the realization that we too one day will share it. And let's learn from the virtues and the vices in his personality, which old age revealed, both to his praise and his shame. We'll start on the optimistic side, shall we, with his virtues. And I think that comes out in his handling of this rebellion that we read about in 1 Kings 1. Look at verses 5 and 6 of that chapter. Now Adonijah, whose mother was Haggith, put himself forward and said, I will be king. So he got chariots and horses ready with 50 men to run ahead of him. There's an ominous similarity, those of you who have been following this series will probably be aware of it very quickly, an ominous similarity between this conspiracy of Adonijah and the much earlier attempted coup by Absalom. And it's a similarity which the historian has in fact subtly exploited and accentuated in order to create suspensiness. Both of these men were royal princes. Both, we were told, were impressive and good-looking. Both had been left undisciplined by their father. And both began their scheming by employing an ostentatious royal cavalcade to impress the general public. Chariots and 50 men to run ahead of them. Like Absalom too, Adonijah's device for actually making his bid for the throne was to give a huge banquet for sympathetic members of the aristocracy. Verse 9. Adonijah sacrificed sheep, cattle, and fattened calves at the stone of Zoheleth near Enrogel and invited all his brothers, the king's sons, and all the men of Judah who were royal officials. So the vibrations from that previous conspiracy of Absalom are all too obvious. And when one recalls what a disaster that was, one can't but feel a sense of grim foreboding. But on top of all those familiar echoes, there was a new and even more sinister factor which rendered Adonijah's plot even more potentially dangerous than Absalom's. For somehow or another, Adonijah had engineered the support of some key members of the old guard. Look at verse 7. Adonijah conferred with Joab, son of Zeruiah, and Abiathar, the priest. And they gave him their support. What the motivation was in these two men, who'd been so steadfastly loyal to David in the past, we can only guess. Perhaps they were anxious at the decline of David. It left the country vulnerable. Somebody had to step into the political vacuum that the king was leaving, they thought. Or perhaps they felt their own personal power base was being undermined by younger men like Zadok and Benaiah, who were gaining the royal favour in David's dotage. Whatever was going through their minds, it meant that with their help, Adonijah posed a formidable threat, all the more formidable because David, in his blissful ignorance of what was going on, ensconced in his private nursing home in the palace, David had allowed this conspiracy to win immense public support. Just turn over and look at chapter 2, verse 15, where Adonijah is speaking to Bathsheba. "As you know," he says, "the kingdom was mine. All Israel looked to me as their king." Now, that may have been exaggerated, but not so much that Bathsheba feels she must contradict him. It's quite clear that Adonijah is on the very brink here of achieving, with Joab and Abiathar's aid, what his elder brother failed to achieve because of their opposition. Namely, the wresting of the crown from King David's head by force. And those who were in David's service and were aware of what was going on in the country had no doubt about the seriousness of the situation. Look at verse 11. Nathan asked Bathsheba, Solomon's mother, "Have you not heard what Adonijah, the son of Haggith? He's become king without our Lord David's knowing it. Let me advise you how you can save your own life and the life of your son Solomon. Go into King David and say to him, 'My lord the king, didn't you swear to me, your servant, surely Solomon, your son, will be king after me, and he will sit on my throne? Why then has Adonijah become king? And while you are still there talking to the king, I will come in and confirm what you said.'" Now, for the benefit of those of you who are Bible students and read commentaries, and would that more of you did, we ought to note that there is a view that you will find amongst quite a lot of Bible commentators that these verses represent nothing more than a counter-conspiracy on the part of Nathan and Bathsheba. David, they say, is so gaga at this stage in his life, he can be persuaded of anything. According to them, the true answer to Bathsheba's question, "Did you not swear to me that my son Solomon would sit on the throne after you?" The true answer, they say, would be no. For they point out that there is nowhere in the book of Samuel where such a promise is ever made. So they suggest that this little theatrical, which Nathan and Bathsheba agree to act out, is a carefully stage-managed contrivance to exploit David's senile dementia for their own ends, convincing him that he'd made a decree of succession in Solomon's favour, when in point of fact he'd done nothing of the kind. It's a kind of manipulation of the will, such as you read about in Agatha Christie's. Well, that rather cynical line of interpretation is surprisingly popular. And so perhaps I ought to explain to you why I think it's wrong. It labours under a great many problems. The first is that it places a question mark against Nathan's integrity, a man who certainly seems to have been, in earlier chapters, a prophet of the highest personal credibility. For another thing, it doesn't really explain why Adonijah didn't invite Solomon to his party. You see that the verse where in verse 10, where he's invited all the royal sons, but he didn't invite Nathan or Benaiah or his brother Solomon. Why not? Surely that suggests he perceived him already as a rival for some reason. This idea of a counter-conspiracy doesn't explain either why Adonijah, with Joab's help, didn't adopt the same kind of manipulative tactics towards his father as they suggest Nathan did. For to be sure, if the issue of succession was open in David's mind, if David's mind was a completely vacant one until somebody got in and closed it for him, then surely Adonijah's name could be as easily inserted there as Solomon's. Fourthly, it implies that David wasn't just physically weak at this stage in his life, but he was completely incapable of thinking for himself. And that is not a picture which is confirmed by the latter half of 1 Kings 1. And fifthly, and most importantly, this view of 1 Kings 1 requires that we adopt a totally sceptical attitude towards the evidence of the book of Chronicles, which, as we were seeing last week in 1 Chronicles 22 and 28, does provide clear evidence
of the public oath to which Bathsheba is referring here in 1 Kings 1. So no matter how plausible and fascinating the political scenario of coup and counter-coup is, which commentators may reconstruct on this theory, those who want to view Solomon as just as much a usurper as his older brother, I find very unconvincing. If it is as they say, why was Adonijah forced to adopt such unconstitutional methods in the first place? Why couldn't he just bide his time? The only answer seems to me this, that though no doubt to many uninformed eyes, Adonijah was the heir apparent because he was David's eldest surviving son, yet succession to the throne of Israel was not assigned that way. Conventional though primogeniture may have been in other monarchies in the ancient world, Israel was a theocracy. It was the Lord's throne that David occupied as God's chosen representative. And for that reason, for one thing, it was by no means a foregone conclusion that any son of David would sit on the throne at all. And even if a son of David did succeed, it was by no means certain that it would be the firstborn. For the Israelite constitution made no such guarantee. Be sure to appoint a king over you, the one the Lord your God chooses. That's what Moses had said. And the fact was that the Lord had so chosen. By a gracious covenant, he'd agreed to give David a dynasty. Though he was under no obligation to do so, he gave it as a gift of his grace to David. But he said his dynasty would be based not on Haggith's son Adonijah, but on Bathsheba's son Solomon. That was his choice. Perhaps there were some in the kingdom who didn't think it was a very good choice. Perhaps Joab found Solomon unconvincing as a candidate for the monarchy, too much of a milksop scholar and not enough of a soldier, maybe. Perhaps Abiathar thought he was too young. Tradition says Solomon was still in his teens at this point. But no matter how well-intentioned the Adonijah party may have been in this scheming for an alternative heir to the throne, the fact is that to try to take power by force, in defiance of God's expressed will in this matter, was a policy doomed to catastrophe from the outset. For the throne of Israel was not to be grabbed by impertinent opportunism like that. It was to be received as a gift, gratefully and responsibly, from the hands of a sovereign God who alone had the power to bestow it. That's how the monarchy in Israel differed from pagan monarchy. And David's virtue, I suggest to you, is revealed to us, even in his old age here, in that he understood that. And Adonijah and Joab and the rest clearly did not. Look on to verse 28. Then King David said, "Call in Bathsheba." So she came into the king's presence and stood before him. And the king then took an oath, "As surely as the Lord lives, who has delivered me out of every trouble, I will surely carry out today what I swore to you by the Lord, the God of Israel. Solomon your son shall be king after me, and he will sit on my throne in my place." If you read on, what follows is quite simply an abdication. David gives his throne away. Look at verse 33. "Take your Lord's servants with you, Zadok and Nathan and Benaiah, and set Solomon my son on my own mule and take him down to Gihon. There have Zadok the priest and Nathan the prophet anoint him king over Israel. Blow the trumpet and shout, 'Long live King Solomon!' Then you are to go up with him, and he is to come and sit on my throne and reign in my place. I have appointed him ruler over Israel and Judah." Now, I suspect only those who have actually experienced high office can really imagine how costly that diplomatic move was for David. Power is a drug, you know. And there have been very few people in the world's history who have had the strength of character to voluntarily surrender it in the favor of others, even in great national emergencies. And David had been the king, the undisputed king of Israel and Judah, for over 30 years. It's not surprising there was a fierce possessiveness about that first person pronoun. My throne, he says. Generally speaking, when people get old, isn't it true that their grasp upon such precious personal possessions becomes more and more tenacious? Wouldn't you say that was so? Yet David here, quite contrary to what many an old king would do, releases the crown from his grasp. He refuses to cling to power, tempting though it must have been for him to do so. He's humble enough, he's realistic enough to recognize that his days of rule are over, it's time to step down. And he's not grudging or sulky in that. He displays a genuine and a heartfelt gratitude toward God. Look at verse 47. The royal officials came to congratulate King David, saying, "May your God make Solomon's name more famous than yours and his throne greater than yours." And the king bowed in worship on his bed and said, "Praise be to the Lord, the God of Israel, who has allowed my eyes to see a successor on my throne today." Now here I say is evidence of David's goodness, his greatness, shining through his character, even in these sad and rather pathetic closing years of his life. The humility that refuses to grab and grasp and cling, and is willing instead to accept God's will, even though it involves loss of prestige and personal sacrifice. Of course, that isn't a new feature in David's life, is it? We've seen it before. We saw it in his flight from Saul. Don't you remember how he had opportunity to assassinate the king? "No," David said, "I won't seize the throne that way. We wait God's initiative." We saw it in his handling of the Absalom conspiracy, meekly leaving the capital city, enduring the scorn of Shimei on the road. "Let him curse me," he said. "The Lord has told him to do it." It's been that self-effacing attitude that has separated David from Joab and his brothers all through the story. For they would cheerfully have killed Saul and Shimei. The end justifies the means. That was their motto, remember? That's why they were with Adonijah now. But David, at his best, was always a man ruled by faith and not by expediency. His life, his future, his reputation, most of all his kingdom, they were in God's hands. And that spiritual insight enabled David to display this kind of generosity of spirit that we find exemplified here in his voluntary abdication in favor of Solomon. And I suggest to you, it has a powerful lesson to teach us. We may not all be autocrats, but each of us has a limited area of power within our control. And it's very easy to cling on to that possessively, when in fact the time has come to surrender it. The mother clings on to her children, doesn't she? Every girlfriend or boyfriend they bring home is criticized. "They can't take my babies from me." The man clings on to his senior post in the office. The career of every bright new fellow in the office is ruthlessly scuppered. "He can't take my job." The pastor clings on to his authority. Every gift in the congregation that might threaten his own supremacy is suppressed. "They can't take over my church," he says. And so clinging on becomes a habit, doesn't it? Until in old age, it becomes a character. We cling to our homes, though they're far too big for us now. We cling to our independence, though we really can't cope on our own any longer. We cling to our job in the church, though it's obvious there are younger people now who would do it better. Learn from David how to abdicate, how to surrender. Learn from him that Christ-like humility, which pushes others forward and counts them better than yourself, looking to their interests and not your own. Let's learn it now while we're young. Young enough to contemplate change in ourselves and in our circumstances. Embed that humility into our personality. as a pattern of behavior by dint of prayer and practice. Let it be there as it was for David. Then maybe at the end, it will still be there in old age. A jewel in our character, still observable when time has eroded so much else about us. For be sure of this, if we have not discovered the folly of clinging possessively to things in our youth, then you can be absolutely sure we will not demonstrate David's virtue of humble generosity in our elderliness. It's what the proverb says. You can't teach an old dog new tricks. That's his virtue then. Let's turn now to look at his vice. And that brings us to chapter 2. When the time drew near for David to die, he gave a charge to Solomon his son. There is a sad and inexplicable inconsistency in us human beings, isn't there? Every pastor knows it from his counseling experience. How is it that that fine, committed Christian suddenly, for no apparent reason, falls into the most gross and shameful sin? It's so unexpected, so disappointing. And yet you observe it again and again. Not just in the young and the immature believer, but in saints of great spirituality and experience. Here in David, we see a classic example, don't we? Like a wise father, he is giving his son some advice. The first half of it could scarcely be improved upon. I'm about to go the way of all the earth. Be strong, show yourself a man, observe what the Lord your God requires. It's a noble and a memorable counsel, and if it had stopped at verse 4, how glad we all should be. Wouldn't we? But for some unaccountable reason, David, whose humility we've just been complimenting, whose reverence for God's word is plain from this exhortation he's just been giving to Solomon, this great and godly David suddenly dives into the most uncharacteristically vicious demonstration of spite, doesn't he? He starts with Joab. You yourself know what Joab, son of Zeruiah, did to me, what he did to the two commanders. Deal with him according to your wisdom. Don't let his grey head go down to the grave in peace. And as if that weren't enough, after a brief legacy to the family of Barzillai, he goes on to pour still more geriatric acid on Shimei. You remember Shimei, son of Gera, who called down bitter curses on me? I promised him I will not put you to death by the sword, but don't you consider him innocent. You're a man of wisdom. Bring his grey head down to the grave in blood. It's tempting to try to make excuses for these bloody bequests. Some try to exonerate David on the ground that he just wanted to see Solomon safely settled on the throne, and both Joab and Shimei represented a threat to that for different reasons. Joab had been part of the Adonijah rebellion. He probably had personal political ambition. Shimei, on the other hand, represented the final residue of that old civil war with the house of Saul, which could still be fanned into a flame at any moment. So say these apologists, David orders the execution of these two because they were a danger to the regime of his young heir. Alternatively, argue others, David was simply executing justice. Joab was a proven murderer. Saul's commanders Abner and Amasa were not the only two who fell to the ruthlessness of his sword. He deserved the death penalty, they say. As for Shimei, well, he cursed the king. And according to Exodus 22, Mosaic law, that was a criminal offense. So David is simply carrying out the demands of the law, albeit in a rather delayed fashion, they say. There's a third group who tried to exonerate David by suggesting that what was really in his heart was superstitious fear. The ancient world believed that both blood guilt and a curse had a kind of magical effect and could bring bad luck on a society unless the spell were broken. So they say David was worried that his son's reign would be jeopardized by that kind of ill fortune. He determined he must do something about it. And there are still others who despair of finding satisfactory vindication for David in these kinds of arguments and so seek to absolve him of his malice by suggesting that the word not has mysteriously dropped out of the text, at least in verse 9, so that it should read, Do not consider him innocent, but do not bring his grey head down to the grave in blood. The great expositor Alexander White, commenting on this particular theory, says, "My heart would stretch a considerable point in textual criticism to get Shimei's blood wiped off David's deathbed." Well, so would mine, but I fear there really is no grounds in the text for amending it that way. And nor do any of these excuses hold water. As for sedition, well, maybe Joab was politically ambitious, but since when has ambition been a capital offence? And as for Shimei, we are explicitly told that he did not join in Adonijah's rebellion, a fact which surely adds ingratitude to David's cruel sentence against him. As for justice, well, of course Joab was a killer, but if David had wanted to prosecute him, he should have done so 40 years ago when the murder happened. Of course Shimei was a reptile who could justly have been executed for treason at the time of Absalom's coup, but David vowed, as he himself knew, a solemn oath of immunity to Shimei. And this deathbed instruction to Solomon represents a shameful breach of fidelity to that promise. And as for superstition, well, David knew better than to believe in such things. He knew that what ruled history was not an impersonal fate, but a gracious God. Blood, guilt, and curses were dangerous things, but there was nothing mechanical about their operation. The answer to their power was not vicarious slaughter, but humble prayer. David knew that. Now, the only really convincing explanation of David's word here, I'm afraid, is the most painful and discouraging explanation. And that is that David still nurtured in his heart a bitter grudge against these men. His vengeful spirit could not bear to be outlived by those he secretly hated with such intensity. And so he ordered Solomon to do what in his hearts of hearts he would have loved to have had the courage and the satisfaction of doing during his life: seeing them dead. Why? Why the resentment? Why the anger? Why the viciousness? Now his defenses are down, and it all slips out in verse 5, doesn't it? "You yourself know what Joab, son of Zeruiah, did to me," I mean what he did to the two commanders of Israel's armies. But no, the word has slipped out, David. "We know now what you mean. It's what he did to you, isn't it, David? The humiliation he brought on you. It is injustice to the memory of Abner that's moving you. It is a personal score you have to settle with Joab." He who had so often opposed the vendetta as a means of settling disputes, with his dying breath instigates one. It is a sad, and I say a disappointing, inconsistency. But what a lesson it teaches us, doesn't it? How long, do you think, had this vicious spite been festering in David's mind? A year? 2 years? Look at the history. It must have been more than a decade. In Joab's case, more than 30 years. Every time he smiled at them, it was an insincere and treacherous smile, concealing a heart overflowing with malicious intent. All the psalms he had written during those years, psalms about how God had forgiven him. But he had never forgiven Joab or Shimei. Not really. The wrong they had done him had been indelibly recorded on his memory, forever prejudicing his feeling towards them, forever exacerbating his lust for revenge against them. In his youth, he could hide it all okay. Nobody guessed the intensity of his secret feelings. Perhaps even he thought he'd overcome it. But he had only repressed it below the level of his conscious mind. It had never been resolved. And in his old age, that bottled vitriol at last ate through its mental container and burnt itself into public expression. It will always be so. You visit the geriatric hospital and listen to the grievances pouring forth. Those unresolved, angry emotions surfacing after years of psychological suppression. Well, does the apostle say, love does not count up the evil. Hate does. Hate files every offence away and never lets it be forgotten. He did that to me. She did that to me. I'll get my own back one day. One day I will. Just you see if I don't. And so a character is shaped. By dint of constant habitual repetition of the same emotions, spiteful, unforgiving, vindictive character. And in old age, it will show through. Like dust swept under the carpet, hidden till the pile starts wearing thin. Don't hold grudges. Remember what Jesus said, if there is something between you and your brother, settle it before you come to church, he said. Remember what Paul said, be angry, but don't sin. Do not let the sun go down on your wrath. If you feel a grievance, express it. Don't bottle it up. Tell the person what you feel, tell the Lord what you feel. And when you've expressed it, when you've got it out of your system, forget it. Whatever you do, don't put it in your mental filing cabinet. No, put it in your mental incinerator. For if we do not learn to forgive and forget in our youth, you can be quite sure we shall be spiteful and vicious as David was in our old age. So here he is then. David, the old man. Bereft of all his former beauty and strength. A pathetic spectacle, isn't he? And yet hidden in those blankets, behind those wrinkled features, there's the same old David, isn't there? Old age takes many things away from us, but the one thing it cannot take is personality. Now that shines through, if anything, more powerfully, more transparently in old age than it does at any time. Old age highlights our virtues. And it highlights our vices. So learn from David this morning the importance of growing old gracefully. We shall all get old. Our contemporary fashion of eradicating the symptoms of old age can't eliminate the reality of it. We're just running away from the truth about ourselves. Sooner or later we must face it. The hardened arteries, the dentures, the pension book, the arthritic joints. And those patronizing comments from the grandchildren, you look wonderful, Grandma, for your age. It will all come to us, to us. So learn from David how to abdicate. There comes a time to surrender power in the family, in the church, in the business. Learn not to cling possessively to things, but to give back to God what he's given to you. And learn from David how to forgive. Don't bottle poison in your heart like radioactive waste. It will leak out in old age, if not before, and it will sour your face with bitterness. You know, a young man once confessed to the French politician Talleyrand that he'd never learned to play whist. Oh, said Talleyrand in French, what a sad old age you are preparing for yourself. But I tell you, if we fail to learn the lesson of David's old age, then our old age will be sadder still. An old age without whist, that we can tolerate. An old age without grace, God save us from it. See, David was a great man. We ought not to allow this lapse into viciousness in his last years to obliterate all the good and noble things we've learned about him in this series. But though he was a great man, he wasn't a perfect man. If we would look for perfection, we must look beyond David, mustn't we? We must look to one who in his death throes prayed not for vengeance on his enemies, but mercy. When they hurled insults at him, he did not retaliate. When he suffered, he made no threats. Father, forgive them, he said. They know not what they do. At his best, there is something Christ-like about David. That's why he's a great and godly man. But at his worst, there is something devilish. So that's true of all of us, isn't it? The good we would, we don't do. The evil we don't want to do, that we do. Our holiness is not perfect, and it never will be. Perhaps that's the most encouraging thing about David. That if grace could be found by one who even at death was as far from perfection as he was, if one like him could write, "You will not abandon me to the grave. You will not let your Holy One see decay. You will fill me with joy in your presence and with eternal pleasures at your right hand." If one as unsanctified as David was could write that, then there is hope for sinners like us too. Let's pray together.